Welcome to the Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show, OuterLimitsRadio.com. I'm your host, Ryan. This is the Death Show. If you're listening to this right now and you've lost someone close to you, my deepest condolences go out to you. And the intention behind this program is to offer you some measure of peace, some measure of healing, and some measure of understanding. I hope you can find the answers that you're looking for, and I hope you can find the peace that you're looking for, and this could be a part of that experience and that journey. This show, again, is the largest show in the history of the Outer Limits of Inner Truth, features over 30 interviews and is broken into 5 different parts. The first part will feature interviews with several esteemed psychologists. Second part will feature several interviews with metaphysical teachers, spiritual advisors. Third part will feature interviews with the Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show Virtues. The fourth part will feature interviews with people who have had near-death experiences, first-hand accounts of actually dying and coming back. And the fifth part of our program will feature a debate with a leading atheist and a top near-death experience researcher. We decided not to incorporate any members of organized religion into this program because I feel that organized religion has a very limited perspective on death and dying. They've held the same positions for a very long period of time, not evolving or changing anytime soon. And their answers as to why things happen, they're not good enough for me. They don't satisfy my curiosity. And I think that a lot of people feel the same way, and they want more answers, and they're really searching for those answers. And while members of organized religion and the leaders probably do a great job consoling the families when they lose someone close to them, unless they're directly in contact with the dead, unless they've died themselves and come back, I don't think they know any more about death and dying than the average person does, nor should they be considered a leading authority on death and dying any more than the average person is. This show is dedicated to someone very special, and that person is Dave. Dave is one of my greatest friends. Known him for a very long time. Actually, the second time we hung out, we were in a bathroom, and I was wearing sandals, and he started peeing on my foot. And I think the average person, we'd be completely horrified and mortified, but I looked at him, and I started laughing, and I said, this has got to be a guy that I have to have be a groomsman at my wedding. The last time we hung out, we decided to drink till all the presidential candidates were attractive, and I think the bartender cut us off. He just couldn't do it. It was just a great guy, a lot of fun. He's the person that you want to have around. He's just one of those rare, unique, great individuals. Something horrible happened to Dave. And Dave, if you're listening right now, I want you to know that this entire show, all the people we interviewed, and every single person that's going to benefit from this show was for you. It was all for you. You were the inspiration behind this. And I really hope that if you're listening to this right now, that this show provides some kind of measure of peace to you. And not only that, I want Lisa Mack to know that this show is dedicated to her. This is dedicated to you, Carrie. This show is dedicated to you, Patton Oswalt. This show is dedicated to every single person out there who's had a broken heart over the loss of someone very close to them. Let us begin. The Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show presents The Death Show, Part 1, The Healers. Joining us now is Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, research psychologist. She's fantastic. We've had her on our show previously. You can learn more about her by going to her website at drfrieda.com. Dr. Frieda, how do you treat people who have experienced a tremendous loss? How do you treat people who are currently suffering that have lost someone to death?
That's a very, very difficult and important question. Everyone takes this differently, but the important thing to know is when you do talk to someone, not to make them feel that they'll get over it, because sometimes you just don't, and sometimes it gets even worse. The best thing to do, and people are so uncomfortable knowing what to do, how do you respond to someone who just lost a loved one, and they themselves need help, and how to react. The best thing to do is not to ignore it. The best thing to do is to go ahead and talk to that person about it, because people who are suffering want others to speak to them. They want to talk about it. They want someone to be able to be a support system for them. So the best thing to do is to ask them, how are you doing? I'm so sorry for your loss. Is there anything you'd like to talk about? Leave it open-ended and absolutely go ahead and let them know that you are there for them.
Okay, well, I think that one of the temptations is, or just a natural human tendency, is that you want to say something that's going to make that person feel better. What are some of the things that you can say to make that person feel better?
Well, the most important thing to say is that your loss, the person that you are mourning, is a very special person. Tell them personal things about the person that you knew. If you don't know that person that well, tell them things you heard about that person, to confirm their feelings. And this way there's a connection and there's a bonding, and that's what people need to hear, that you think something also and you agree that this is somebody that they should really recognize as important to them.
Okay.
And to other people.
Now, what if you are somebody who has experienced the loss? What would you recommend for them to do? If something happens, they experience, someone very close to them has died. What are some of the first things you recommend for that person to do?
Number one, if you have reoccurring feelings that are negative, which means you can't function, you can't sleep, you can't eat, and that is not stopping, it's not going away, you definitely need a professional to talk to, because then you need someone that's ongoing. So that's the first thing to look out for. If you have dreams about this, and they're not nightmares, sometimes those dreams can be comforting, not to be afraid of that, because it's your memory, and it's a support system. So that is okay. So there's a fine line between knowing when things are problematic or when things will leave eventually. And it's hard to know. So my recommendation is give it some time. Give it a few weeks, maybe a few months, maybe even a few years. But if it's something that you can't tolerate, do go see somebody.
Okay. Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, I want to thank you so much for providing that very helpful advice and insight.
You make it easy, Ryan. What can I tell you?
Thank you. And to learn more about Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, you can go to our website at drfrieda.com. And please be on the lookout, because Dr. Frieda is going to have a new best-selling book released in the next 2 months, and you'll see her all over TV and radio. Dr. Frieda, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, and I love your show. It's always great to listen to. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Joining us now is Miss Lisa Luckett, founder of Cosmina Enlightened Living. She's an author. She's a speaker. You can learn more about her by going to her website at Cosmina, CozMenna.com. Miss Luckett, sadly, you lost your husband on September 11th. I was calling. How do you recover from something like that? What advice do you offer from somebody who's experienced a personal tragedy of that magnitude?
Thank you, Ryan, first of all, for having me. My first answer would be that 9/11 was the first event of its type on American soil. So it was brand new, without a skill set for any of us. Now, because terrorism's been in the news so much for the last 15 years, that it's kind of more commonplace that people are thinking about this. The answer is, I lost my husband in 9/11, but it wasn't, they were two separate events. There was the death of my husband and the father of my three little kids. So 9/11 was really his car accident, his cancer, his, heart attack. It's how he died. Separate from that was the national, international episode, tragedy, terroristic event of the two buildings being hit almost simultaneously, and the home run that was hit for the terrorists in them falling almost again simultaneously on international television. So So to prepare for something like that, the truth is, in the 15 years since that has happened, nothing else has really, really happened. I mean, where I live here in New Jersey, the sun has been coming up every morning just the same way as it did. It's been, we're the same. The world here is the same, except that we have changed in our perception. So to more answer your question, it rendered me very open. I was so much in shock. I had been prepared over a series of life events, not realizing that it was preparing me to handle this. But the interesting part is I was a nursing mother of a four-month-old, and I kind of bounced that morning after the initial hour and was fully functional because my husband had walked down in the event, in the first attack in 1993. So I'd been through that. They went back in with knowledge. My mother-in-law, my husband, was a little overweight and was in a very stressful job and was not eating well and exercising, and my mother-in-law was very afraid for him. So she talked about his having a heart attack all the time. So it made me prepare for his death. So I'd had a real terror experience and then having this kind of fearful preparation. So I ran his death through my mind literally hundreds of times. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to pause. So if you do that, if you actually expect and prepare in your mindset that somebody close to you is going to die, what is it? It makes the process easier.
Yes, absolutely. So I think what's happened is we've become so afraid to talk about death. You know, kind of whisper, you know, kind of like cancer. That the truth is, death is a reality of life. So my belief would be if you can remember that you are strong, that you, by thinking about it, doesn't mean it's going to happen, because it is inevitable that it will happen down the road. But in preparation, I bought as much life insurance as I could afford. I knew where all the documents were that were important, and I let it go. So the morning of was like a bounce. I bounced. And I never would have expected that, and I was literally fully functional and fine.
But I mean, wasn't the shock, wasn't it devastating when it happened? I mean, but the whole shock of it.
Sure.
I just can't imagine what that must have been like.
It was, of course, devastating to watch the drama of that unfold in my family room, holding my little kid's hands, you know, but the truth is the first time, so I had a lot of prior knowledge of this more than a lot of people. Yes, the first hour, absolutely. My son told me I was screaming Ted, 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 and my husband's name was Ted, and stamping my feet. I don't even remember doing that, but he does. He was four. So, because people started flooding into my house, the phone started ringing, I had to start dealing. It wasn't like I could crawl under a rock. I was receiving their terror, their fear. I was calling people to find out where they were, my friends who had husbands there. You know, where are they, accounting for everyone? So it was a very busy morning. It was a very busy week, multiple weeks, months. It was chaos. In just the form of news, information, neediness, just on a neediness meaning people needing to know, coming in to touch me. Are you okay? If this happened to me, would I still be okay? Lisa's okay. I can touch her, so I would be okay too. It was a very interesting projection of the fear because it was such a shock.
You can imagine. So if somebody – you're talking to someone out there right now who's has experienced a shock, the shock of a loss of a loved one, what advice do you give to them?
To stay as calm as possible. To let nature, God, the universe, source, let nature hold you. Let it literally give the ebb and flow that will come. What I was always afraid of was this – catastrophic, debilitating pain that would last for 24/7 for an indefinite amount of time. And that isn't at all what I had. First of all, I was the mother of three young children. So children, if you're a widow with young children, you have to function. So they provide a distraction. And distraction in grief is really healthy distraction. Not avoidance, don't go, not medicating, not, you know, doing things in that way. But when it's not on your mind, because nature is going to give you the break, it's going to render you numb at points. Take it. because the grief will come back. It's always going to come back because it's always morphing and changing. But with time, it dissipates. The pain will dissipate to the place where you ultimately welcome some tears. You welcome that sad moment. I call it happy sorrow, where you have this memory and it hurts, but it's a way to touch them. It keeps them alive. And one of the things I think that's I was afraid of is I would forget him. And the truth is you never forget the person you love because you've loved them. It's the love that connects you, you know, and that's bigger than all of us. So we often, and I think in our society, we confuse letting go with forgetting. But it's really important after the first couple of years. I always say there's the year of firsts, like we've all heard. And that's when you're going through everything the first time without that person. What people don't really talk about is the year of seconds, which is when you're doing it all by yourself without really the support of everyone else because they've gone back to their lives as they should because life is for the living. But we can bring forward our loved ones with us in a healthy way. And that is what I was able to do with my husband and my children. And my kids are now 22, 19, and 15. So they've grown up, you know, without him. But he's very much present in their world. So you don't ever really lose them if you allow nature and trust that you're going to be given what it is you need. In the sense of this kind of cosmic care, that just don't torture yourself with shoulds. I think culturally we are enabling a lot of pain that the person projecting in their experience onto me, the people that would look at me, all they can see is, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. When the truth is, what I got was so much love and support that I would never have been able to conjure when I was thinking about his death. I didn't know the mind-blowing power of prayer, of literally international, global prayer from people I never knew, friends and strangers alike, and it lasted forever. I still get it to this day. But that's because it's 9/11. If you're talking about normal grief, a normal loss, it gets quieter a lot faster. But you do get those people to come in and take care of you. And what I found so interesting, and I've asked many people of their own experiences of death or cancer or tragedy since, it's often the people you expect will be there are not there. And it's new people that kind of come out of a secondary or tertiary friendship who rise to the occasion and bond with you in this beautiful way. Again, silver linings, you can't, or we don't talk about enough to say, you're going to be okay. You will be okay.
And when somebody is trying to console another who's experienced a horrible tragedy, what are some of the best words or things a person can say to that other person?
I think what I found a lot personally was that people would say, let me know if you need help. Well, the truth is I was never going to let them know. First of all, there's not a lot anyone can do. So I found that when I've gone through it, it's more doing, if you think of something you want to do for that person, just do it.
What if you do something and that you're infringing upon them and that you're crowding up their space? I mean, I just want to make sure that.
I don't think anyone's ever, I mean, people can be hurting. But there's really never a time that you can give too much. I mean, I don't think calling, maybe leaving a message, writing a note, not necessarily being in their space with them, dropping something off, leaving a plant. It's just a thought. It's just a thought that carries people. Because there's really nothing you can do. That pain is that pain, and it is individual to the person, I don't think. You can certainly be there for whatever they ask. Bring them food. I mean, if I could count how many lasagnas I had, it would be high. But that's what people needed to do to also help themselves, because that's part of loss and tragedy, is when someone you know has a loss, you want to help them. You also realize there's not much you can do, but you project, wow, what if that was me? and I need to take care. I need to feel better about this, so I need to do something for them. That is very acceptable and very normal. So that's why so much food is given. And that's why, you know, in my little company, we knit a shawl called a Cosmina, and it's about taking care of someone who's hurting, about wrapping yourself in metaphoric love, in a metaphoric mother's hug. And that people make Cosminas for exactly this reason, because there's nothing else you really can do, but it's a way to take care of someone very subtly. Because grief doesn't happen, you know, it's not over in a week. For the person who lost something, it's a change forever. Can you live with it? Absolutely. Do you get better? Absolutely. Will you be happy again? Absolutely. But in those initial days and weeks and months, all of those gestures, so any loving gesture is wonderful. It's wonderful. Don't expect a response. People in that grieving moment may be so lost in their in the depth of it that they can't write a thank you note. There's not maybe a lot of manners around it. But know in your gesture that you have done everything you can do. And that would be my answer. Don't ask what you can do, just do. And it will be appreciated, and it will help.
Ms. Lisa Luckett, I want to thank you so much. I really thought you provided some great sound advice for people. And to learn more about Ms. Luckett, please go to her website at Cosmina, CozMena.com. Thank you so much, Ms. Luckett.
All right. Thank you.
Joining us now is Dr. Pat Basile. She is internationally acclaimed and host of the Dr. Pat Show. She's also the founder of Transformation Talk Radio. You can learn more about Dr. Pat Basile by going to her website at thedrpatshow.com. Dr. Pat, an honor to have you with us. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, I'm really thrilled to be here, and thank you for all that you're doing in the world.
Thank you, Dr. Pat. So what would you recommend to somebody who's experiencing pain and suffering of a loved one? What do you tell that person who's experiencing the pain and suffering of a loved one?
Yeah, I'll tell you what you don't tell them. You probably don't want to walk up to them and say, you know what, things happen for a reason. That's probably
all
something
right.
You don't want to say.
Imagine it.
You know, I think this is a really big topic, and it's something that's really near and dear to me. As a matter of fact, you know, today is Wednesday. 3 days ago, we lost a very dear friend of ours to a battle with cancer. When I was 6 years old, my mother committed suicide. So death is something I'm very familiar with. But if we're talking about, you know, the loss of a loved one specifically today, I think it's good because there are many, many different losses. And, you know, I think for me, what I'd like to share with everybody, what I've discovered along the way. I basically lost my mom when I was six. I lost my sister in 1992, my stepmom in 93, my mentor in 97, and about two summers ago, we buried two of our sisters. So loss is something that I'm very familiar with. And the thing that I want to say, you know, for people listening is this. How we work with, help, support someone that's close to us or someone we know, this is not a one-size-fits-all. It really isn't. And I think the thing that I want to say to people, whatever it is that you want to know and how to support a loved one that is experiencing loss, whether it's an individual or it's a job. You know, I studied job loss for 8 years, so I have 1,200 pages of interview notes. I can tell you quite a bit about what that feels like. But the thing that I think I want to say here in the short time we have is whatever you do, whatever you say, please make sure it comes from a place of authenticity. Because I think that, you know, the thing that we all know that when someone loses someone, you don't know what it's like. We don't know what that experience is like. It's different for everyone. But the thing that I think that we can all understand is that whatever that love, whatever that caring that individual had for that person that is gone now is very real for them. And so for all of us that have experienced loss and are you know, have family and friends and loved ones that go through it, they really, really are looking for a way for all of us to show up as Kuan Yin. And that is to show up as an absolute pillar of compassion. And that doesn't mean we figure out fancy things to say or, you know, look up some quotes, sometimes just a simple call or a baked pie, if you have traditions like I grew up with, coming from an Italian family, it's an Italian feast. But the thing that I've come to know is that we all experience grief and loss differently. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. As a matter of fact, the stages of grief that were once developed were not meant for the survivors. That those stages of grief were actually developed for the people that were leaving this earth skin. You know, so there are so many things that we learn. But I love this. I love this idea. I love when we think about, you know, hypocrisy, and we think about, you know, what it was like to have, you know, all of us look at what the word, you know, illness means or disease means. You know, we're looking at a rite of passage that isn't just about the event of death. You know, there truly is an entire journey that happens with folks. Now, clearly, I gave you a couple of examples in my life,
you know,
where folks, you know, I didn't have a way to be with them through this journey. But how I experience, you know, my process of loss is boiled down to two things. So I can share my own experience, but I'm really hesitant to say what it's going to be like for other people. And here's what I've come to know about death for me. First of all, there's the actual death and the loss of the individual, the person, who they were. You know, what does that mean to lose a mom? What is it about that that has such grief to know that that person will not be available to me in that same form? And then there's the second part. And that second part starts with every story now I start to tell myself about my life, what my future is going to be like, what it's not going to be like, how it's going to unfold. And so the question really then becomes, am I experiencing grief of an individual, or am I too experiencing the loss of the way something was? You know, somebody shared a quote with me not too long ago. I never forgot it. And most of the time when people leave us, we experience such a wide range of emotions, anger, frustration, resentment. It depends on what happened. And the thing that was said to me is, you know, there's this interesting definition of forgiveness. Forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. So I think what happens when someone passes on, that we're at a loss for trying to make sense of what it comes to mean. You know, we're not really quite there. You know, I love the work of Manly P. Hall. And one of the things I remember about reading that he said, sorrow, suffering, and loneliness are the great builders of character. You know, man never becomes truly great until his heart is broken. You know, that is the supreme test. Those who deepened and broadened by their experience rise triumphant from the ruins of their dreams and pass on to fuller destiny. So for me, that's what I hold in the forefront of my life now. When I look at this idea of someone passing or something not occurring anymore, a person not being in my life, am I going to be saddened by it? You bet. You know, the people that have left, am I saddened by them? Yes. But how can I not now create stories that are less about that person and more about my own fear, my own concerns, my own well-being, and my own future? And I think that's what I've learned after experiencing many, many losses in my life, is getting an understanding, where is the real grief in the process? What am I experiencing? The other thing I realized, I learned a lesson from the Dalai Lama. And I remember a story that was told to me once where the Dalai Lama was doing a conference and had a bunch of these thought leaders, you know, in the room with him. And he was laughing it up and having a jolly old time. And all of a sudden, when his number one person walks in the room, and the number one person walks in the room and whispers something in the Dalai Lama's ear. And the next thing you know, the Dalai Lama drops his head for something maybe like 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 seconds, just drops his head. Clearly a shift in energy. Then picks his head up and continues where he left off. And later on, what was discovered was that the Dalai Lama had learned that his closest, dearest friend was just executed. So you see, we have this idea about grief, that grief has to take decades of our life, that it has to take enormous amounts of time and energy. I think the most important to think about in loss is, am I really grieving this person, or am I fearing a future that is so unknown? And I think that's been the most important thing for me to discover. Because am I really grieving this person not being here today, or am I in fear of a future now that may exist without this person? And then the third thing, is it both? Because if it's both, how do I get some help with that? So those are, you know, for me, those are just a few things that I guess that I've learned along the way. But, you know, I'm also this person that, you know, created a positive talk radio network because I do believe in the power of positive energy. And, you know, how do I do that? How do I put myself in a place where I'm allowing myself to take the time I need to understand the true loss of an individual that may be so important to me and separate that from an attachment to a spirit that is now released and gone? You know, I had a teacher once, very important person to me, took me out on my first vision quest and literally said to me right before she herself passed away, you know, said to me very clearly, Pat, listen, you know, you're holding on an attachment for a soul that has moved on. And what right do you have to hold on to that soul for yourself? And so I really think that this is a complex issue that I believe the only way I've been able to get through it has been to really step back and get some help about understanding, what am I feeling today? What is going on with me? And can I be okay if I'm afraid? You know, can I still be in deep, deep grief and sorrow for someone and at the same time be afraid of a future that is so unpredictable and a past that I so am afraid of let going of? So those are some of the most important things to me when you ask that question of what I learned in my own life experience. I think the thing that I love to keep in mind is sometimes we think we know what it's like for somebody else to grieve something. We either think, oh my gosh, I do understand it, I've lost everybody in my family. Or we have an idea, man, you just lost your job, it's just a job. And either way, the thing that I would say to anybody listening to this is, you don't know what it's like. So the best that you can do is literally show up as Kuan Yin. And if it is you that is in that place, you still show up as Kuan Yin. And make sure that the compassion that you have for yourself is first and foremost the number one thing on your list. I know that's a long answer, but it's really
no, it was a great
question.
Answer. No, it was a great answer, Dr. Vasily. And if you are seeing an individual mm-hmm. who's lost a loved one start to engage in self-destructive behaviors or activities they wouldn't normally engage, like they're drinking very heavily mm-hmm. or they're lashing out, or they're doing things that would be totally out of character for them, are you infringing upon their ability to mourn in a way that they see fit by preventing them from doing those activities? Should you kind of just let them go on their own and only kind of intervene or step in if they're engaging in activities that would put their own lives or the lives of others at risk?
Yeah, I mean, that actually is a much easier question. So let's say it's my best friend. She's been my friend's best friend since 1973, and I watched her go through an enormous loss. And then I watched the aftermath of that loss. And she's watched me go through all those losses, right? Here's the one thing I know that we would do for each other. What I know about that is if in her case, I saw her behaving in ways that I thought she would harm herself or someone else, forget about the psychology of things. Let's just talk about friendship. I would sit down and say, I'm worried about you, or I would get myself on a plane to help her. In a case of me, she knows what behaviors are a little bit out of line for me. And so if she saw me engaging in those, I guarantee you, she would bring every ounce of New Jersey to the Pacific Northwest and straighten my butt out for real. That's what would happen. So for me, if I'm watching somebody that I know well enough to know that something is happening here that's going to do harm to them or another person, and I'm comfortable enough to show up in a loving way to support them through it, I will do it. But I'm not sure that I have or believe I have the right to interfere with somebody's grieving process, whatever that looks like. I mean, I know what my grieving process was all along the way, up until 2 years ago with my sisters. But I don't know that about another person. There's something key, though, to your question, and I want to make sure we go back to it. And it's the question you said to me about doing harm. Yeah, I would step in like a hot knife in butter. If I saw someone that I knew, and I knew what they were capable of, and I saw them taking an action that would hurt themselves, forget about it from a psychological point of view. I would step in, you know, from a compassionate point of view. Now, what would I do? It would have to depend. If somebody said, I'm going to kill myself, I'm telling you, you call 911. That's what you do. If you saw someone pull a knife out of a drawer, or if you saw someone threatening to take a bottle of pills, you have to take an action around that, because those things are very clear. But I will tell you this, that is not the norm. People don't openly come out and say that. So those of us that, you know, work with other people in the world or are friends with them, we have to pay more attention to the subtle cues. You know what I'm saying? Like if somebody is used to showing up at church every Sunday and all of a sudden they're not there, that's just an example. Or let's say you go to a typical meeting and they're not there. Or let's say you have a group of friends and all of a sudden they've missed 3, 4, 5 events. Somebody should be picking up the phone and saying, how are you doing? Right? But here's the thing I want to say to you, Ryan, about this. If this is a friend of mine, none of us should let it get to that place. If this is somebody that we know and we know they're going through this kind of loss, let's not wait till this is what's going on with them. If we could learn how to show up in compassion and support while somebody is going through this, I think that's going to be the key. Because people that go through loss, they want to be alone. They want to isolate, right? You know, they might want to sit there and drink a fifth of Jack Daniels or, you know, maybe more so than that. They got a couple of pills in the pill cabinet. Maybe they want to do that. But if there's another way to help them, to support them, then that's the way to go. I'm just going to kind of end with this because this is important to me. You know, my journey is a spiritual one. And so first half of my life, I try to resolve things at the human level. I don't do that anymore. You know, it's taken me a while to really build a spiritual practice that actually makes sense to me. And so today I have to go to that place. And that place is usually a place of gratitude for all of the things that I got to enjoy and love about that person or that job or that other thing. That's not easy to do alone, but once you're able to do it, energy changes. So, you know, your question is a really important one because we will literally watch people go down the pathway of destruction, if nothing else, Ryan, just on social media. And if we see it and you have the heart and the courage to step in and offer a hand, that would be the way I would go.
Dr. Pat Basile, I want to thank you Thank you so much. You can learn more about Dr. Pat and hear a fantastic show by going to the website, thedrpatshow.com. Dr. Basile, we really enjoyed having you on. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Awesome. Thank you.
Joining us now is Miss Anne-Marie Socia,
licensed professional counselor associate, clinical certified hypnotherapist, and neuro-linguistic program. You'll learn more about Sam Reed by going to our website at wavesofchangenc.com. Ms. Hosha, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. When you are treating someone who's experiencing the shock of losing someone close to them, what are some of the most advanced techniques you can fully utilize at your disposal or that people can utilize at their disposal in order to begin the healing process or accelerate the healing process?
Well, there are several techniques and modalities. Some of the ones that I specialize in, and certainly there are many more, but the ones that I use are hypnotherapy, mindfulness, meditation, and cognitive behavior therapy. What that really means is I help the person, whether individual or group, tap into their feelings and allow them to grieve, because everybody grieves differently. There's no tried and true cut method that you have to do it this way, but help them tap into their feelings, help them express them, help them move through the grief process, whatever that looks like for them, whether it's hypnotherapy and learning how to relax and accepting life is going to change and dealing with how it alters, or doing mindfulness and being in the moment and honing in on what's really happening and how do we feel and how do we move forward. And all of it at the crux is talking about it and really just being there.
Right. Is there anything that a person can do to kind of restructure their brain in order to minimize or compartmentalize the feelings of anguish that they have when they lose a loved one? Is there anything that they can do to kind of, let's say, make sure that they can take care of a 9-to-5 job, take care of their primary obligations, without having the extreme pain and suffering of losing someone bleed into that and affect them in their daily lives?
There are several things. One of the first things I would say is acknowledge the pain. Accept the fact that, you know, there's going to be grief and loss and sadness. And take a deep breath and maybe take several deep breaths. Remember the positive. Stay positive. Try to find things that make you happy. And when you have to do the 9-to-5 job, because I know it's tough, you're going to go to work and you've got this loss at home that you're suffering. Maybe a husband died or a wife or even a pet, for example, and you're grieving, and allow yourself X amount of time a day to let that grief happen. Hypnosis or hypnotherapy is amazing at helping you kind of find your inner chi and relax and just be in the moment and tune into what's going on, but yet find the happier side of it and be able to go forward.
Now, you specialize in hypnotherapy. Can you hypnotize someone to not feel pain or not experience the pain and suffering of a loss of a loved one? Can people come to you and ask for that before?
People have come and asked me for that. What I generally tell people is I'm not going to guarantee that I will take away the pain completely. I will help minimize it. I will hold their hand as long as it takes to walk through it. I will be there step by step to guide them towards a happier life, a life that's changed and altered in ways that they probably didn't want it to.
Okay. Now, if you are successful in doing hypnosis and helping them to forget, minimize the pain, is that in one way, shape, or form potentially putting a ticking time bomb within their subconscious that may manifest physically? Because if they don't acknowledge the pain right away or they minimize it, is that something that could long-term hurt them?
I don't recommend anybody ever take grief and loss and try to push it aside and not deal with it. So through hypnotherapy, we would be dealing with it. We'd be talking about it, talk about it in long sentences and long paragraphs to get to the root of it. And then through hypnotherapy, relax them to a point where it's not as traumatic, but it's still there. Because trauma and grief and loss are things that we need to deal with. And just putting more, yes, I agree, that could potentially be a ticking time bomb, because at some point it's going to come back out and it's going to be something bigger to deal with versus dealing with it up front.
Well, and just to take a step back in terms of the grieving process, when you are grieving, what is actually happening from a psychological perspective? What is occurring when you're mourning a loss of someone? Are you what is happening to the body? What is happening to the soul? Is there a certain step process that a person would have to go through? Are there certain goals or markers that a person can kind of track and know where they are at what point during the grieving process?
Everybody is different, first off, so anything that I say beyond this is individualized, and every person is different. But typically speaking, if you're grieving more than a few weeks, you might want to reach out to someone. If your grief or your loss is taking over your life, physical symptoms, meaning you're crying all the time, you can't get out of bed, you don't want to go to work, you're not eating, you're isolating yourself, if you're doing that for a prolonged period of time, again, a few weeks or more, that's when you need to reach out to a professional therapist and say, I need someone to talk to, or reach out to your clergy or to a trusted friend and say, okay, I need to check in. I think that this is becoming a concern. If it's a day or two or a couple weeks or less, I wouldn't worry so much. Everybody's got to grieve in their own time frame. But if it's 6 months and you haven't left your house, there's a problem.
All right. Now, are you able to possibly discuss the brainwave frequencies of people who are in extreme suffering or extreme mourning? And the reason why I ask that is I'm curious to know if a person does meditate, which you are, you know, you talk a lot about meditation.
Yes, I do.
Can that actually shift and actually help the person improve their mental well-being? Can that help them accelerate the grieving process?
I can tell you I'm not an expert on the brainwave piece of it, but I will tell you that I can alter the state to happier. I know most of my clients can come in and they'll be very stressed. Their heart rate is beating faster. They might have blurry vision. They may feel completely stressed out, whatever that term means to them. And after a session with me, they're calmer, their heart rate is lower, their blood pressure is down to normal. They're able to think and function properly. They don't have blurry vision. They're not panicking, if you will. They're not suffering the grief and loss as dramatically as they did prior to seeing me or working with me personally. And I think that's true for most hypnotherapists.
Okay. And what advice would you give to a person who's trying to offer consultation or healing to a person they know is very close to them that has experienced a horrible loss?
I would reach out to the person in whatever method they're comfortable with. If it's giving them a hug, holding their hand, having a meal, just sitting and listening. People often just want to be heard. They want to know that someone cares. So if someone's in grief or loss or suffering, just sit next to them and let them share with you what they need, because everybody needs something different. Commonly, I tell people, tell me your story. Tell me what you want to hear. Tell me what would make this better for you in the moment, other than bringing the person back or the animal back, because I can't. What can I give you? What do you need? And sometimes it's just taking deep breaths with them and letting them just cry. Just be there and let them cry.
Excellent. Ms. Anne-Marie Socha, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. To learn more about Ms. Socha, please go to our website at wavesofchangenc.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Joining us now is Dr. Rick Doblin. He's the founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, otherwise known as MAPS. You can learn more about him by going to the website at maps.org. Dr. Doblin, thank you so much for being with us today. And right off the bat, okay, good.
Yeah, just thank you for having me. I'm really glad for this opportunity.
Our pleasure. There are people who are experiencing a lot of pain and suffering as a result of experiencing death or losing someone very close to them. How does your organization work, and how have marijuana, MDMA, and other psychedelics utilized to help people deal with pain and suffering?
Wow, that's a great question. Well, MAPS is essentially a nonprofit pharmaceutical company trying to develop psychedelics and marijuana into approved prescription medications. And these are drugs that have incredible therapeutic potential but have been abandoned by the pharmaceutical industry and not supported by the federal government and so far not even major foundations. So it's through individuals and family foundations that we've been able to generate support for the research. And what we're doing is trying to understand, based on both the political context and also on the therapeutic context, how do we move psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy and medical marijuana through the regulatory system? And so what we've focused on is for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, again, it's not MDMA that's the drug, that's the treatment by itself. It's MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. So there's a larger context of psychotherapy. And what we felt was that the first priority would be post-traumatic stress disorder, that there's a perceived national obligation to veterans and others who are not successfully treated by the currently available medications or psychotherapies. They do work for a substantial number of people, but there's too substantial a number of treatment-resistant people. So we, for the last 15 years, have done pilot studies with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD in Spain, in Israel, in Canada, and throughout the United States. And we're gathering all of that data right now, which is very promising for submission to FDA as part of what's called an end-of-phase 2 meeting to plan the pivotal phase 3 studies. And we currently anticipate approval by the FDA in 2021. That's our current timetable.
Oh.
We also, though, in order to try to start the psychedelic renaissance, we're now at a point where there's more psychedelic research than at any point in the last 45 years. The two symbolic areas where we needed to start research, one was at Harvard, where Timothy Leary had been, and that's where some people say, yeah, that's where it went off the rails. And then the other was to start research with LSD as sort of the quintessential psychedelic. And so in both of those cases, we were able to do so in the context of treating people who were anxious about dying, who had life-threatening illnesses. So at Harvard, we were able to start a study with MDMA in cancer patients with anxiety. And in Switzerland, we were able to start a study with LSD for cancer patients and people with other life-threatening illnesses who are anxious about dying. And we've gotten very good results from both the Swiss study, and we've now, the U.S. study at Harvard, we have only very minimal results. The study was ended early because it was hard for us to recruit people, because we had to say that people had only less than 12 months or left to live, and a lot of people didn't want to be in the study because of that. They felt like that was admitting that they were about to die. So we started another study with MDMA for people with life-threatening illnesses in San Anselmo, north of San Francisco. And that study is recruited. It's going to be in 18 subjects. We've recruited about half of them, and the early results are very promising. And I think there's two different mechanisms between the classic psychedelics like LSD in working with people that are near the end of life and MDMA. And so with the classic psychedelics, with like LSD, you're trying to help people have a mystical experience, to let go of their fears of death or to explore their fears of death. And then under the influence of LSD, people often have this sense of connection, this deeper sense of unity, this transcendence of time and space. They kind of realize that, you know, it's not just our individual biography, that we're the product of billions of years of, you know, evolution, and that you're part of this bigger thing, and that death is a natural part of it that you don't need to be scared of. So the work with the classic psychedelics with people facing end of life is more about this mystical experience that helps people focus on enjoying the time that they still have instead of sort of mourning the time they're not going to have. And with MDMA for people near the end of life or who are worried about life-threatening illnesses, it's more about a reduction in the fear and anxiety about that. But MDMA is very relational. It opens up, it stimulates oxytocin and prolactin, hormones of nurturing and bonding. It opens up people's sense of connection with people in their lives, and it stimulates loving feelings. And so people who are anxious about dying, a lot of times what they really want to do is have the conversations with their loved ones that they've been unable to have so far and sort of settle up their lives. And there's also an unusual property of MDMA that makes it really good for a hospice setting. And that's where you start talking about real pain, is that MDMA is a drug that synergizes really well with opiates for pain medication. And what we find is that in the hospice setting, a lot of people are so in pain that they're so medicated that they're barely there at all. They're tranquilized and they just sort of drift towards death. But when you combine MDMA with the opiates, what happens is the stimulant properties of MDMA wake people up. And then MDMA also reduces pain. So you get better pain control. You need fewer opiates, and people are alert and open-hearted. So we've seen situations, not in formal research settings, but where people have gone on and tried this anyway on their own, that within days of people's death, they're able to really recapitulate their whole relationship with loved ones and have these miraculous moments of sharing that transforms this whole process. And it's sort of, it emerges out of being a tragedy to being a celebration.
Now, what about people, Dr. Doblin, who are the friends and relatives of the person who's dying? When they are experiencing a severe trauma of losing a loved one, how does something like MDMA or another psychedelic drug, when properly administrated, be utilized to accelerate their healing process or accelerate their understanding of what has happened and put them on a trajectory of a healthy mental recovery from such a severe loss?
Well, that's also a great question. Now, MDMA can help people in the grieving process. And sometimes grief can become so difficult for people that it almost becomes post-traumatic stress disorder, that people, remember the person that died, that they're always feeling sad. They cannot really fully grieve, and they can't really fully move on. And so MDMA helps people to let those emotions out and to fully cry and fully grieve the loss. And then also people can then celebrate the life and, really feel like there's an element of, the relationship that they had with the person that will never die, that they will always have their memories. So the challenge, though, is that in the current system of prohibition, trying to make a drug into a medicine, we have to work with diseases, diagnoses that are in DSM-4, that are in DSM-5 now, that we have to treat, specific illnesses. So for somebody that's heart sick at the loss of a loved one, unless it turns into, clinical anxiety or depression or PTSD or something, we can't make a medicine to treat them because it's not a clearly defined disorder. So that's the challenge. But we're making a major progress in a study that we're about to start next month with post-traumatic stress disorder with MDMA. And there's a therapist that have been aligned with the Veterans Administration, and they've developed an approach called cognitive behavioral conjoint therapy. So conjoint means couple. So it's a therapy for the couple where one member of the couple has PTSD, but the PTSD affects the relationship. And we've been able to get permission from FDA, from even DEA and the Institutional Review Board, to give both members of the couple MDMA. So the person that has PTSD is part of a study to make PTSD into a medicine. And the person who is the couple, who does not have PTSD, they're part of a scientific study looking at the relationship and how this relationship has changed through these MDMA experiences. So we could imagine that one day that could be expanded to people who are anxious about dying, because as you said, it really affects the whole family and the whole circle of loved ones. And other people need to go through this grieving process as well. And while they're not themselves immediately dying, there's a lot of difficult emotions for them as well. And it makes sense to give not just the person who's dying MDMA, but to do it in a family setting. So that's going to take us a while to get to that point. But I do think that over time, we're going to be developing MDMA and other drugs into prescription medicines. They'll be administered by trained therapists in special psychedelic clinics, and it will be initially just for the patients, but then it'll expand out to include the families as well.
Okay. Do you feel in any way, shape, or form that the factor of big pharmaceutical companies missing out on a big profit could be a reason why – your work or this activity has not been developed quicker? Because if you have something that can help a lot of people in a very quick fashion, wouldn't it undermine a lot of these other pills that are out there that maybe would have the effect over a longer period of time? Do you feel that in some way, shape, or form, medical innovation is a deterrent towards allowing this to happen, to become full fruition?
Well, not exactly the way you said it.
Okay.
I think that right now, from a regulatory point of view, we're able to get permission for psychedelic psychotherapy research all over the world. So there are no fundamental regulatory hurdles to doing that. But from the pharmaceutical point of view, they don't really understand psychotherapy. They understand medication, but they don't understand psychotherapy. And the psychedelic drugs and marijuana also are in the public domain. With the psychedelics, they're not the treatment by itself. It's psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. So the pharmaceutical industry just doesn't look at this as a profit center because the drugs are in the public domain. That's why we're doing nonprofit drug development, also because of the political controversy, and also because really they just don't understand this mixture of pharmacotherapy and psychotherapy. But I think your main point, though, is will these drug assisted psychotherapies, once they're approved, offer an alternative to the daily pills that the pharmaceutical company offers for PTSD, for anxiety, for depression? The answer to that, I think, is yes. That for some people, psychedelic assisted psychotherapy will be a preferred treatment option. And in some significant number of cases, it will address the problem sufficiently so that people don't need daily psychiatric medication.
That's really great. And can you see your work when it becomes, or as it becomes more accepted on a mainstream level, being a great asset to humanity, or being a means to have people live their lives happier and not deal with such post-traumatic stress disorder, not only from experiencing the death of a loved one, but from a traumatic event that they may have had in their life otherwise?
Definitely, because what we see now around the world is traumatized populations and multi-generational trauma. We're understanding more and more about epigenetics, how while, you know, changing the actual genes is through mutations is a longer time frame. In one generation, the epigenetics is about what genes are turned on and turned off. And that can change within and be passed on from one generation to the next. And so if we can interrupt these cycles of multi-generational trauma, I think the legitimation of psychedelic medicine for treating PTSD can have a major impact on helping humanity, because we can help people stop coming from such a traumatized place and maybe make peace in certain situations where they're just trained to hate the other and to make war. But I do think, and this is the bigger issue, and this is why I'm really focused on this work, is in order to help humanity, because of what we just said before, that you know, we can only make drugs into medicines for clinically diagnosable conditions. What we need is a ability to work with people who are not diagnosed with an indication, but who are open to global spirituality, who are open to deeper understandings that are not clinically, psychiatrically ill, but might be, you know, scared of the other or too rigid in their beliefs, or might want to just be exploring. And I think that the classic psychedelics have been used for thousands of years to facilitate religious experiences, and that these experiences tend not to produce fundamentalists, but they tend to produce people who see the fundamental unity of everybody, that people will have more tolerance for people who are not like themselves and think we're all engaged in this birth and death cycle. We're all trying to figure it out. You know, we all have more in common than we have different. And so I think the benefit for humanity, Albert Einstein said that our technology has exceeded our humanity. And I think if we look around with the problems with global warming, with the problems with nuclear weaponry, you know, that we really have a incredible advancement of technology and of intellectual sophistication, but we don't have, as individuals and as a species, the emotional and spiritual maturity to cope with our technological achievements. And therefore, we need a large-scale advancement and a more spiritual approach, less greedy, more compassionate, more sympathetic to others. And I think psychedelics can play a major role in bringing that about. And we saw that in large part in the 60s, in a small subgroup of people who were motivated to work on environmental movements, work against the Vietnam War, work in social justice movements and civil rights movements. You know, the classic, of course, is John Lennon, All You Need Is Love. That's a song he wrote after he took LSD. So that we have this social transformation that's happening anyway because of technology, the globalization. But some people are retreating into fundamentalism as they're confronting other peoples, other religious systems. And some groups are becoming more rigid, but others are becoming more open. And I think the introduction of psychedelics in a legal way in our context where people can have support for these experiences can have a major impact on the thriving of the human species.
Dr. Rick Doblin, I want to thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing your insight. I know you're very busy, but I want to tell you I really enjoyed having you on. To learn more about Dr. Doblin, please go to the website at maps.org. Thank you so much, Dr. Doblin.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. It's great questions that you ask, very challenging and difficult questions and important ones.
Thank you. Joining us now is modern intuitive therapist, Ms. Beth Miller. You can learn more about Ms. Beth Miller by going to her website at BethMillerMeditations.com. Ms. Miller.
Yes.
When you are working with people, welcome to the show first off, and when you are working with people who are suffering and grieving from the loss of a loved one, what are some of the ways that you feel are effective, not only for you to console them, but other ways for people to console their family and friends who are enduring the loss of a loved one?
That's a really good question, yes, and thank you for having me. So one of the things we have to do with people that are grieving and going through a difficult time after loss of someone or something is give them a lot of space to feel how they feel without thrusting a lot of expectations on them about how they should feel or how they should get over it. Everybody's timeline for grief is different, and usually it ebbs and flows. It kind of moves like an uncontrollable roller coaster for a while. And what people mostly need is somebody to listen with compassion and not use words like should not, or that they should move on, but just to really be present with them.
Okay. And you've incorporated in some cases angels, guides, when you're working with people, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So when you are suffering, when you're enduring the loss of love, and how do your angels and guides come to you, and are you likely to get a visual or more kinesthetic feeling of their presence when you are at these very low points?
So I find something really interesting happens, which is I'll have a client that's coming in, modern intuitive therapy combines psychotherapy with life coaching, energy healing, science, spirituality. It's sort of all of those things in one. And somebody will come see me for grief or maybe for some other issue that we're working on in person or over the phone. And I can feel my guides and my angels pretty quickly because I can hear them, and I can also feel them on my body. So I feel them play with my hair. They become very present on my skin. I know that they're around me. They make noise in my ear. That lets me know to pay close attention. And I always ask my guides to communicate with the other person's guides so that I give the highest form of a reading to them and psychotherapeutic advice to them instead of coming from my own ego. I think that's super important. I'd rather have the counsel come from a higher source than from me. But one of the things that I think is super cool is that somebody might come in with an issue. Let's say, for instance, I had one of my clients who was struggling with this question. She said, am I good enough? What should I do next? How should I move forward? And her father came to me during the session to answer those questions. So he had never shown up in session before, and I'd worked with her many times, but he showed up that day to help her with those questions, and he gave her advice on them because that's what she was struggling with, and that's what he could help her with.
It's pretty amazing. And what would you say, if it's possible, to identify 4 signs of healthy grieving and 4 signs of unhealthy grieving, where you're not doing or following proper things?
Okay. So healthy grieving is crying, talking a lot about the person, talking a lot about what happened, questioning it, like, I don't understand, this seems so strange, how did this happen, being confused and disoriented by it, and not being able to move on right away. That's really healthy. Unhealthy grieving would be to try to avoid it entirely, to not think about it at all, to be drinking, drugging, using alcohol, sex, lots of work, distractions, to not feel at all. It's not that you can't use distractions. It's okay to use them to some degree. But if that's your main coping method, then you definitely want to go speak to someone that's going to help you to feel your feelings and be with them in kind of small and compartmentalized ways instead of getting flooded by them.
Okay. Can I just, when you are doing that, if that is one means for you to do it, could that, theoretically speaking, be a temporary means of survival, that you can't face it, that the grief could be so overwhelming that at that point in your life you don't have the capability of experiencing the full magnitude of the situation? And if that's the case, can that actually be a healthy means? Because if you accept it full-fledged on, it could actually, theoretically speaking, destroy you.
Well, yes. But I'll say this. Human beings are extremely resilient. They're extraordinary. Most of us doubt our ability to cope with pain, but we actually can do it. And we show great agility in being able to do it when we're willing to sit with it and face it. Can distractions in small doses be a really important part of psychic survival for a while? Without a doubt. However, that can't go on forever, and it shouldn't, because that means you're not going to actually juice from the experience the ways that you're going to grow from the grief, the ways that you're going to expand from it, and also the ways that you're going to expand and grow from the life of the person that passed. You know, their life and also their death is in great service to all of us if we pay attention to it and we look for the purposes, the purpose and the meaning of what their life had, and also even in their death.
Right. And if you don't acknowledge or come to terms with, let's say, the loss, and you are using all these means of distracting, how is that going to affect your life in the long term? And do you actually risk developing split personality, where you're basically becoming 2 or 3 different people, or even actually going down the path of a schizophrenic because of that, because you're avoiding it?
Okay. So I would say in almost every case, probably not. Having multiple personality disorder, or what's considered a dissociative disorder, or being schizophrenic, has a lot of other factors to it besides just grieving. And just having a hard time coping with grieving. Grieving is so hard on us that we will try to do anything we can to avoid it. But most likely we wouldn't create other personalities those two really are, don't have a lot of cause and effect there. I don't think that's something to worry about. I think instead what would happen is that you'd get more and more and more disengaged from your own life. You wouldn't be able to feel life, the highs and the lows of it, all the finesse of life anymore, the joy of life, because you're disconnecting from it. And then you have another thing to grieve, which is that you're not living your own life anymore either. And so the only way to go through hell is to go through hell. And I think the one thing that people have to remember is they've already experienced the worst of it. which is the original pain that, of what's happened, but to then find ways to cope with it and come to peace with it, to be able to radically accept it. Those are things that they're skills and tools that they can be taught to do. And also, energy healing like EFT is super helpful because it can help take the edge off of the grieving and make it much easier to cope with.
All right. And when you're talking about thinking about chakras, what happens to a person's chakra system when they experience the initial shock of the loss of a loved one? And if you are going to be working on someone or a person is going to be working upon themselves, are there any particular chakras you recommend balancing and healing first and making that a top priority and building things from there?
Yeah, top priority is your first chakra. When you experience something as disorienting as like a traumatic death or something that's very jarring in your life, you're going to get ungrounded. You're not going to be grounded in yourself, in your own body. You'll probably be a little dissociated for a while. Those are normal parts of grief. And so your first chakra is the one that provides that feeling of safety and being tethered by the umbilical cord of life. And that'll get knocked out of balance.
Okay. So, what's the first chakra's name, though? Is there a certain name for it? Is it where is it located?
The first chakra is the sacral chakra. So, I mean, the root chakra also, that's commonly called the root chakra. It's at the base of the spine.
Okay.
The color of it is red. So that chakra will get, you know, imbalanced by that. So one of the best things that you can do for the first chakra, when you feel unsafe in life, you feel like the material world is an unsafe place to be, there's been death, is to go outside and walk among trees. Take your shoes off if you can, walk in the grass. Your feet being grounded in the soil or on grass is incredibly effective. Being among trees that have a very grounding chi, I mean, they are literally grounded by roots, is extremely effective. It's like it'll do the work for you.
It's interesting you said that. A very close friend of ours, he had recommended that you go against a tree and you put your head, the top of your head against the tree, and he said the tree will cleanse your crown chakra. It'll basically go through and cleanse you and clear you. I don't know if that's something that would resonate.
Absolutely, without a doubt. If you're willing to, and I'm willing to do this, and I think it's super effective, if you're willing to literally hug a tree, also you could put your back up against the tree and sit up against it, or actually place your chest up against the tree and hug it. Trees are extraordinary in that they really are great friends of ours. They provide our ability to breathe, and they provide an incredible service to us. But one of the things they have is such a powerful chi that they will absolutely ground us. And if you hug a tree, they will cleanse you.
Okay. Now, I want to come back to one thing we touched upon earlier, which is the difference between healthy grieving and unhealthy grieving.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring this to your attention because I feel like in my life, when I've been at a low point or I've experienced suffering, the biggest jerks in the world I've tended to meet around these periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if lower astral entities tend to gravitate towards people who are grieving and try to push them and to drive them and really cause them a lot of unnecessary pain. And I'll give you an example of this. A person could be experiencing a tremendous amount of guilt or suffering over something that could be something that they may not necessarily be responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's something you have experienced, and I'm wondering how people could actively protect themselves from any other outside force that would try to seize upon their grieving and kind of make their grieving an etheric meal. I hate to say the word.
Mm. Wow. Do I think that happens? Yes, I do. I also think that when people are in a lower or darker place, that their energy is like a boomerang. And so the world around them is going to mirror back to them how they're feeling, and that's what they're going to attract into their life. So unwittingly, it's not just that those beings might be seeking them out, but unwittingly, they're also attracting people like that to them. And also, it's really difficult to be around positive people when you feel really low. And so you're going to sort of unconsciously want to be around other people that are in the same kind of space you are. So my suggestion, though I think this is kind of hard for people that are grieving to do, but my suggestion is to do a pretty simple exercise where every day you actually fill yourself up with light from the inside. I think this is one of the best protection methods that you can use. Instead of just creating sort of an orb of light around you, which is to keep things from coming in, I'd rather have people saturate themselves with light from the inside. So I just ask them to grab a piece of universal, beautiful consciousness in the form of golden light, to place it inside their chest. And then every time they breathe in, to let that light expand until it saturates every cell, every atom, every organ in their body, down to the tips of their toes, up to the crown of their head. And if you're fully saturated with light, nothing can come in because there's no room for it.
Dr. Beth Miller, I want to thank you so much. I really thought you had a lot and you had a lot of great insight. Thank you. And to learn more about Ms. Beth Miller, please go to our website at BethMillerMeditations.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joining us now is Michelle Beckhardt, licensed psychotherapist, hypnotherapist, who specializes also in past life regression. You can learn more about Ms. Beckhardt by going to her website at MichelleBeckhardt.com. That's MichelleBeckhardt.com. Ms. Beckhardt, welcome to the program and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. It's my honor to be here.
Thank you. When you are working with someone who's experienced a tremendous loss, loss went to death, what are some of the first things that you will do to work with that person to put them on the road to recovery and to begin their healing process?
Well, at first, I talk to them about giving them permission to grieve, to feel sad, to not feel normal for a while. And so many of my clients who have lost someone dear to them feel that they should just be getting over this. And you know, that life moves on. They may take a few days off work, and then the rest of the world forgets that they are in grief. And it's important to be kind to oneself, to reach out to friends and family members who are supportive, and just to allow the emotions when they come up, whether it's sadness or anger, depression. We have to remember that those emotions are stored in our bodies, and so it's important to let those emotions flow out as they come up, because as we try to talk ourselves out of them or tell ourselves we really shouldn't be feeling that, we should be over this by now, those emotions get stored in our physical bodies and can then they just grow. And then we come to a point where we not only won't allow ourselves to feel the sadness or the negative feelings, but we're not able then to experience our positive emotions like joy and happiness.
Okay, so by repressing these or not dealing with these, what are some examples of these feelings seeping into our daily waking life without us knowing it?
We start to feel numb. We start to just lose interest. We discover that we don't feel or experience the love from other family members or friends or members of our support network. We might just start feeling angry. And that's often what happens. We'll start feeling angry and irritable, and we don't know why. And often when that irritability comes, it's just sitting on top of a whole pile of sadness that needs to come out. So watch for the irritability and that numbness, that feeling of, I can't feel anything at all anymore, really should be a signal to us that We're suppressing the emotions and those feelings that need to come out.
All right. And when you're talking with people, they're probably trying to figure out why. Why could something horrible happen? Why did it have to happen to me? When you talk with them, do you look at and tell them that there's an external force that is responsible, a collective consciousness or supreme being that is responsible for orchestrating all things, or do you relate to patients that these are actions of everyone's initial doing? Like, how would it, what is your perspective on that?
My perspective on that is that we are all soul, and that as soul, we choose our life circumstances before we incarnate into a lifetime. So as soul, we choose what lessons we are to learn, what qualities we are to acquire in a particular lifetime, what souls that we are going to incarnate with, and what lessons we are going to learn or provide for them. And we choose when and how we die. And after doing hundreds of past life regressions and life between life regressions, as I've guided my clients through the death scene, in every single circumstances, or every single circumstance, they have felt a feeling of extreme peace and love when soul leaves their body. They are guided to a place that's filled with love and acceptance, and they meet with their soul family. So the idea of this is some random act that wasn't there, if we can let go of that notion and recognize that this loved one, this soul has completed their journey here. They've graduated. They've done what they were here to do, and they have chosen to leave. We can honor that. We can make this a celebration rather than this is unfair. How could this happen to me? Somebody outside themselves decided to make this happen, and God is so unfair.
There's something we talked about at the beginning of the show where I guess some of the common things people say is, oh, you know, you lost so-and-so, but they're in a better place. I want to tell you from my personal perspective, I love being with my family, and I don't care how wonderful heaven could be or how I have all these soul families, I don't think that there's any better place in the universe than me with my family. It's probably the fruitiest thing anyone will ever hear me say, but it's the truth. Mm-hmm. So this idea that we say that they're in a better place, is that necessarily true? Is the reality, can some people say, listen, the best place that they could possibly be in is in their physical body with their loved ones or doing some devious act that they're very happy doing?
Well, you know, I think that feeling that the best place any soul can be is with the family they've chosen in this lifetime is sort of a narrow perspective. And I don't want to say selfish, because it's not selfish in the sense that we feel as the person who has lost the one we loved, we feel this huge hole in our heart, this huge hole in our life. But we have to recognize that that family member or friend, that lost loved one, is moving on to a place now where they can continue their soul's evolution. So they're continuing. They're going to a place where they can continue to grow and evolve and learn as soul. Perhaps in their next incarnation or incarnations. So we have to ask ourselves, is really the best place for them to continue here with their family and loved ones, where perhaps they have completed their mission, they've learned their lessons, they have completed their purpose here, and now it's time for them to start their next journey and continue to evolve.
Okay, why would we have to come and go through a physical form to experience unconditional love if our origin is that of unconditional love? And apparently the spiritual realms, a lot of our celestial ones, are pure unconditional love. So why would we need to come to a physical body to learn or to appreciate unconditional love, and many of us probably already do. I can't imagine a single being that would be immersed in unconditional love could not see that and recognize and say, hey, that's fantastic. Why would we need to come into a physical body to understand that?
Well, that's a really good question. And my answer to that is that where on the other side, where there's complete unconditional love, we don't get practice in dealing and coping with any sort of adversity. So say a soul is born, and my understanding of this is that they come from a place where everything is playful and loving, but there's really not much of a sense of responsibility. So they come here first to the physical plane where things are very, very dense, and their thoughts don't manifest. And their initial lesson here is learning to survive and learning to cope with adversity. Because wherever we go, there is going to be that. We have to learn to manage those emotions that come with being in a physical body, like anger, like sadness, like resentment, like jealousy. Those are states of being that we need to learn to resolve and release in order to grow a soul. So you see, what I'm saying is that all souls, when they come here, don't have that understanding or haven't developed that quality of unconditional love. And so they may come in with a sense of anger or greed or whatever it is. So souls evolve and evolve and evolve. As they deal with adversity in difficult situations and also very loving situations to really gain those qualities on a soul level, if that makes sense.
Speckhart, when you're doing hypnosis sessions, is there a possibility that a conscious being, a person, can actually have a correspondence with their higher self and change the game plan for which they came into this life incarnation? Because I think when you are in a physical body, you sense and understand up close and personal pain and pleasure, probably in a way that your higher self can't comprehend because its focal point may not be in the physical body where your conscious, waking conscious is. That being said, can you renegotiate the terms for which you've come into this life for with your higher self? Can you decide and say, look, we're going to learn these lessons. We're not going to learn them in pain. We'll take the longer way home. We'll learn them in a more peaceful terms. Do you have the freedom and the capability of renegotiating those terms with your higher self?
Well, that's a really good question. And
thank you.
My just intuitively with that, I do believe that if we acquire the quality that we are, one of the qualities that we have come to learn, then we can possibly, I wouldn't call it renegotiate, but on a soul level, we always have free will. So in every experience that we go through is sort of a spiritual test. And so say we pass a particular test and acquire the skill or ability in a situation that doesn't require much pain. It usually, though, very much requires trust and risk. And we pass that test, then we may not need to go to or go through a situation that brings pain because we've already acquired it through our trust in ourself and spirit and our willingness to take risks. So yes, things can change with our free will. I think that we experience more pain and more difficulties when we allow fear to control us. And then it's when we don't do what we need to do because of fear-based beliefs or fear of taking risks, it's like then the universe or then soul or our guides and spirit, you know, might give us a little, you know, pinch or knock on the head and say, well, okay, if that's not going to work, we're going to bring you a biggie. And so the challenges could get bigger and more painful as we fail to move on with the tests or the tests that are given us. You know, each little one is, I don't want to say a failure, but if it's brought to you and you respond based on fear, well, then the next one may be more difficult. So, yes, I do think that we can renegotiate, and that is based on our willingness and trust to go forward and take the risks and always choose based on love rather than fear.
Excellent. Miss Michelle Beckhardt, licensed hypnotherapist, licensed therapist, past life regression expert. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And to learn more about Ms. Beckhardt, please go to our website at michellebeckhardt.com. Thank you so much, Ms. Beckhardt.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
And this concludes part one of The Death Show, Healers. Thank you so much to all of our amazing guests. To learn more about the Outer Limits of Inner Truth Radio Show, please go to our website at outerlimitsradio.com. Thank you for listening.